All right, welcome everyone. Day 4 of TechEd, 8 a.m. Glad you could all make it out here. My name is Alex Turner, the program manager for the Visual Basic and C# compilers at Microsoft. And I'm here today really to talk about the two things that have consumed most of my time over the last 2 years. And those are async, the new async support we have in .NET 4.5, as well as the Windows runtime. It was about 2 to 3 years ago that we really took a step back and said, what can we do in the .NET framework to really reimagine asynchronous programming, to make it that much simpler to call APIs that are going to give you results back sometime in the future? And, you know, we had working groups, went around, talked to different teams around Microsoft, and what we came up with ultimately was a combination of, you know, API support, some new patterns that we have in the base class library, but also some new language features that you may have seen. In Visual Basic and C#, the new async and the await keywords. How many of you guys have had a chance to try out async in either language? Okay, cool. A few of you, yeah. And so that was something that we really pushed hard on for a while. And at the same time, though, this release, we also had another focus, which was Windows 8 and the Windows runtime specifically. In Windows 8, when you're writing Metro-style apps, you're targeting this Metro UI, but you're doing so by calling into Windows runtime APIs. And, you know, it's no coincidence that we have a talk here that's talking about both of them together because the Windows runtime has taken a big bet on asynchrony in terms of trying to keep the apps that you write on top of Windows 8 responsive. And, you know, it's no, it's nothing really too weird here. We have .NET looking at asynchrony. We have Windows runtime looking at asynchrony. If you look at JavaScript, you know, the APIs that you talk to there, the ones that are going to go out, do network requests, those are all asynchronous APIs. And it's for a good reason. It's all in the service of not blocking threads. And, you know, this helps you out both on the client and on the server. You know, for example, you look at the client. What do you get on the client from not blocking threads? Well, you get responsiveness. You know, a lot of these environments, JavaScript, if you're doing Silverlight in the browser, a lot of these places, you have to do certain things on the UI thread. For example, in a browser, you have to do network requests on that one thread the browser gives you. And so if you were to be using synchronous APIs, if there was a network request you wanted to do that would come back in 10 seconds, if that was synchronous and blocked until the result came back, you wouldn't be able to use that thread for that period of time. So it's very important. On the server, you care about scalability. So you have some number of request threads that are going to handle incoming requests. Well, if let's say you're waiting for another web service call to come back, you don't want to block that thread, that request thread you have, because threads aren't free for you on the server. And if you start to have a bunch of your calls that are blocking, waiting on others, you could start to hit a bottleneck just in terms of how many threads you have that are just spinning their wheels waiting. And so, you know, asynchrony really is becoming the norm. It's the sort of common solution to this problem, having an API take some callback, something that you want to do later when some result is available, when an operation is complete. And, you know, you can do this manually, you can pass callbacks to an API, but really the industry is moving forward to this more modern abstraction for the same thing, something called futures, right? And futures are this idea that you have a first-class object that represents a piece of ongoing work, similar to how, you know, IEnumerable was this currency when you use link. These future objects become the currency when you're doing asynchrony. And, you know, being able to reason over these things, have them as first-class objects, combine them, becomes something that's very powerful when you're setting up these kind of APIs. And so, you know, independently, we have .NET, when the languages were doing this kind of thing. The Windows runtime is also basing its future in terms of asynchrony on future objects. But, you know, these are different API sets. You know, the details of exactly how these future objects work are a little bit different, but they're actually far more similar than they are different. We're going to explore some of those similarities and differences today. And, you know, how many of you guys have tried any Metro-style development, tried out using the Windows 8, RC, beta, any of that? Okay, a few of you. Well, some of this is actually changed from build. We gave out the developer preview at build. You know, we had something out there you were able to consume, and since then we've been taking feedback, figuring out how we iterate on that, and actually now, since build, these two worlds are actually a lot more close in terms of the way things are shaped. I'm going to go over some of those differences and the improvements we've made since then. Just so we can get on the same page, and we all know when we talk about synchronous APIs and asynchronous APIs, sometimes these can be overloaded terms. Let's just take a look at a simple example here. So we have an API download data. goes out, maybe it takes some URL, goes, fetches something, brings it back, returns it, and I'm going to pass that result, that resulting data object, over to process data, some other helper method I have. And when I do this, assume this is the thread, this is a diagram of the thread that I'm on, this is the diagram I have. I'm going to say, all right, well, I'm downloading the data. I'm going to consume some little amount of time actually kicking off the request. But then afterwards, my thread is now blocked. You know, I can't do anything with this thread because I'm synchronously awaiting the return. And, you know, when I finally get the return, my thread's going to be here, take the data, hand it off to the process data method. But in that interim, I can't use this thread for any other purpose. And if this was my UI thread, my app is now going to be hung. You can't drag it around. If it's on a device, you can't scroll it with your finger. So that's very bad. Whereas, you know, on the bottom here, we have really the asynchronous equivalent. So instead of calling download data, I'm calling download data async. I'm passing it the same parameters, but you see, instead of actually getting the data back, what I get back is this future object. It's something that isn't the actual result yet, but that represents a future result that I'm going to get. And because it represents a future result, I can get back that future object immediately. And then in the future, you see, I say, all right, well, future.continueWith, when you finally have a result, go ahead and continue execution, call this lambda expression that I'm giving you, pass it the data, and I can go on. So you see, I'm then giving it a little anonymous function here. I'm going to have it use that to process the data. And so I kick this off. I call download data async in the same way. But while things are processing, while I'm waiting for that other server to send me the data, it could be network delays or anything, I'm able then to do other things with my thread. You see, my thread is now free. And, you know, importantly, again, if this is my UI thread, I have the ability to stay responsive within my app. Assume all these purple blips here are other UI events, things like touching on a screen or clicking with a mouse, those things can actually occur. The app's going to stay responsive. I'm sure you've all seen apps where you do something for a while, something is hung, and then all of a sudden, you know, 10 seconds later, all the events suddenly bunch up at the end and resolve, right? And that's not what you want out of your app. You want your app to be responsive. And it gets even more severe when you think, all right, what happens if I want to do two things in parallel? You might have two network requests you want to make, two downloads to do, and they could be to two separate servers. It may not actually matter that you do one after the other. But if you only have one thread where you can do these things, and it's on the UI thread, you're going to get stuck. You're going to have to stop while you're making this request, finally get the data back, and do the next thing. So not only is your UI unresponsive, but your app is also going to have lower performance. It takes longer to get things done. Whereas if you have asynchrony, the moment you get control back in your UI thread, you can kick off the next request. And so you can see what we're able to do just with this idea of future objects, or not even future objects. If you just have any API that accepts callbacks, you're able to benefit from this kind of asynchrony. So works at the API level. Why do we actually need language innovation here? Well, you start to see, look at the bottom code, it's already a bit more complicated than the code above it, right? You know, the code above, your sequence of how your operations work is simply having one statement follow another. I'm downloading the data, I get it back, and then I go ahead and process it. But below, I'm saying, well, I'm downloading the data, and then here I'm kicking off, maybe here's a callback to do later, and imagine if that callback itself was going to process the data, get a URL, and then do some other request, or, you know, do some file I/O or some other thing I'd want to be asynchronous. And then maybe there I'd have to do another call and then chain to another Lambda, which would do some stuff and chain to another Lambda, right? And I would quickly get into this sort of nested Lambda hell, right? You talk about with go-tos, if you abuse them, you end up with spaghetti code. The best way I've actually heard this put in terms of having these little nuggets of functionality that all chain to each other is macaroni code, right? And that's where you can quickly get to if you have a lot of asynchrony in your app that you're using to get responsiveness. It benefits you, but it can quickly make your code much harder to maintain. So what we've done in the language in .NET 4.5 in both C# and Visual Basic is to introduce new keywords. We're going to see them, the async and the await keywords. And these keywords let you do asynchronous programming without actually specifying all the callbacks yourself. It's still based on that same idea of having callbacks, but those are going to be generated for you by the compiler. You get to think of your sequential code flow, and the compiler will do the rest. And so just to go and explore this, I have a demo app I'm going to show you. It uses async and await already, and we're going to explore some ways that we can expand on this. And specifically, this is a Windows 8 Metro-style app. And so let's take a look here. So I'm going to go in. We're going to run this app just so we can see what it does already. And this is a pretty simple app. It's based on one of the default templates, so the UI is nothing special. But it's really just a simple app that's going to generate photo mosaics. The idea of a photomosaic, you've probably seen them before. It's where you have one target image, where you're trying to generate an image that kind of looks like a certain thing. But you're going to assemble that image out of a bunch of little tiles. And so you have some theme for how you get little tile images. You pick and choose them based on their color and their shape. And then you assemble them all together to approximate some target image. And so that's what we're going to do here. It's an app that calculates that kind of thing. And what you see on the left here are a set of tags. And so these are Flickr tags. We're going to go out, use Flickr's web API, do a query for a given tag, pull back some images from that API, assemble those tile images together to approximate whatever image the user specifies. And so if I go here, I click flower. We've said we want to search for flower images on Flickr. I'm going to pick this image of me. This is me speaking at Tech Days Belgium a few years ago. Kind of epic lighting back there in the background. And I hit OK. And now what it's doing, it downloaded a few images. You probably don't want it to download 1,000 images, so we already had some of them cached. But it went and downloaded it, it figured out which images fit best where, and you see it makes sort of a first approximation of my face up there on the screen, and sort of metro-style Alex made up of tiles. And so we have this here. This is a simple app, and you can see it's already, you know, as I was doing this, I could have moved the mouse around. Things were still responsive. We were using asynchrony. And let's see what that actually looks like. So I'm going to go back into the code here. And you see that the core logic we've got here is inside this item list view, item click event. So item list view is just that list that was on the left that was showing a bunch of Flickr tags. All the logic is kicked off when you pick one of those items, and so you see the logic here. And you know, if you've done any sort of XAML programming before, a lot of this is going to start to look familiar. I'm just pulling apart what item you actually clicked on here from the event args, making sure it looks selected in the UI. And then going down here and setting up the status text saying that you're choosing the source image. And what I'm using here is now a file open picker. And if I look at the type of this, I can see that this is windows.storage.pickers.fileopenpicker. And I see that the top level namespace here is Windows. And that tells me this is a Windows runtime API. So this is one of the new Windows 8 APIs that C# and VB now have the ability to call into when you're writing Metro style apps. And so I go initialize this object. I can treat it just like any old .NET object. I have properties I'm setting on it. So I'm setting the file type filter. I'm setting the view mode. And then I go ahead and I actually call an API. So here I'm using pick single file async. This is the API method that's going to say I want to ask the user to choose one file from their operating system, from their documents folder, wherever they want to browse to, choose that image, give it to me, and I can process it. And you see, though, that there's some clues that I'm actually dealing with an async API here. Well, first of all, the name of the method says pick single file async. But when I hover over it, I see some things in the quick info. First, I see, well, the IDE is telling me that this is awaitable. And so, you know, something that's awaitable, that means that this object that's being returned is one of those future objects. It's something that I can then await to actually go ahead and get that result in a sort of latent way. And I see that the thing that is giving me the return type here is iasync operation of storage file. And so iasync operation of T, this is one of the future types that's defined by the Windows runtime. Calling a Windows runtime API is an async API, and so it gives me back this future object. And this is an object I can use to register to know, hey, when things are complete, when you actually have a result, go ahead and tell me so I can continue, so I can process my callback. And so, you know, I could hook this up manually, but you see I'm actually doing something different here. I'm taking my future object, and I'm calling this await keyword on it. And await is saying, hey, I actually want to go ahead and wait for that operation to finish, but I want to do so in a way that respects the thread that I'm on. I don't want to block on this thread, but I also don't want to create another thread. I actually just want to schedule a callback when this is done using that future object. And when it is done, what I want to do is continue running this method. If you think about it, the callback that I would write if I was doing this manually would be the rest of this method, right? And so that's actually what the compiler here does for me. It says, all right, you've set await. You're passing in this future object to the await expression. And that means I'm going to look at the rest of your method. I'm going to figure out how to package that up as a callback. And I'm going to tell that future object, hey, when you're done, here's what you want to do next. You want to resume running this method where you left off. And the reason we have this method that we're able to easily pause and resume is because up here at the top, we marked this as an async method. That's the magic that tells the compiler, hey, go ahead and make this a method that I can pause, a method I can resume every time I get to an await. And so when execution runs through here, what happens is it gets to this await, it schedules the callback, but then if you think about it, there's nothing left for it to do here. You know, we've scheduled the callback, but we don't want to actually go on. We need the file before we can go ahead and open it. So we might have 5-10 seconds to wait while that network request processes, or in this case, while the user is picking a file. And so what I do in that case is I return. So under the covers, every await that you see, or most awaits that you see, the ones that are actually awaiting things that aren't done yet, those are going to turn into returns, and you're going to go back to your caller. So in this case, you think the user clicked something, the message loop, in this case, it would be WPF, it'd be XAML, whatever UI stack I'm using. The message pump is actually going to go ahead, call my event, I get here to the first await, I return back to it, and that's how I have my responsiveness. I've returned back to the message pump, suddenly other UI events can process, and things stay responsive. The user can move the mouse, click, hover, do all those kind of things. And only once the data is actually available will my code pick up here and resume on the same thread. And so I keep going here. I say, all right, original file, I have that. Now I take that file and I open it. Again, I'm calling open async. This is a Windows runtime method that's exposed on storage file. And yes, I see it returns me an iasync operation of irandom access stream. So again, by awaiting it, I take this iasync operation of random access stream and I just get my irandom access stream. I'm pulling out that logical result type out of the future object. All right, so I keep going here. I then see this code. Well, if you've done any XAML programming before, this should look familiar. This is how I get a bitmap image. This is an image source that I'm going to give to a XAML control. In this case, it's that control you saw on the right side of the screen that shows the target image that we're trying to approximate. So I set that up. I then go here, I'm setting more status text, and then I do a bunch of processing. I say, all right, call my little synchronous helper API that gets me the Flickr URI for the tag you clicked. You clicked on flower, we want to go get the URI that's going to get flower images. And then I say here, all right, HTTP client.getAsync. Well, what is this? If I look at HTTP client, this is actually a new .NET API. This isn't a Windows runtime API. HTTP client and .NET 4.5, this is the new HTTP API to replace web client. And I'm calling getAsync here, and you see it's similar. It shows up as being awaitable. The name of the method ends with async, but it returns a slightly different type. It returns task of the response message of the result type that I want. And so what I'm seeing here is a .NET async API. This is following the new pattern that we've established as part of this whole async effort. And task is that .NET future type. And so we saw iasync operation on the Windows runtime side. We're seeing here task on the .NET side. But you notice I'm able to await it in exactly the same way. And I'm able to just continue on in my code. And it's actually not necessarily that important which of these two things is Windows runtime versus .NET. I could treat them all identically. And so I go on. I get back here from var query. I get an HTTP response message. I call another API that returns me a string. This is going to go ahead, read as string. You know, it could be a large string, so it does that asynchronously, gets me back the data. I then take that string, pass it here to parse photos from XML. This is another helper method I have. It's going to pull apart the XML response I got from the Flickr API, get me a list of photos. I then go and actually fetch those photos. So this is going to do a series of network requests to actually get all the tile images that are missing that I don't already have cached. And then once I have those, I now have both parts of the equation. I've got the target image I want. I've got the set of tiles I want. I pass them to my create mosaic async function. I do my calculation. Look at this. This is actually CPU-bound work, right? So this is a bunch of number crunching to figure out which tile goes where, but I'm able to abstract over my method in the same way. We'll actually see how we can make one of these kind of methods that does CPU work and lets you blend it in very easily. We'll see that in a bit. And so I've done that. I now open up the result image. You know, this returns me back a file with the resulting mosaic image. I do the same thing again. I load up the stream. I set it over to the right side to actually show the result mosaic that we generate, and then I say that we're done. So this is my control flow. So you can see this, and you can see that actually from top to bottom, even though I'm doing a bunch of async operations here, if I actually look, there is no less than 7 awaits inside this method, right? And so I'm breaking up my method into a lot of little chunks. And if I was to write this manually, I'd really have to have 7 chained lambda expressions that were all nested within one another, or 7 little methods that all call into each other, right? And that's even still only possible here because this is sequential code. Imagine if I had a loop or if statements and things are starting to get really nasty trying to figure this all out manually. And so the compiler actually doing all of this work for me lets me represent this as a flow from beginning to end, something that I can look at and reason about just as simply as I would my synchronous code. All right, so this works. How do we go about improving this, though? What else can we do that looks better, that improves this app, that does some more stuff that we want to play around with? Well, one thing we could do, if we look at this, it is nice that we have this code going from top to bottom, but the method's getting a bit long. It's taking up a few screens as I scroll through, at least at this font size. And so we could start to pull this out. Maybe we want to make a helper method that does some chunk of this code. And so, for example, here, I have this code which says, this is the code that's like going and choosing the source image. I might want to pull this out. Maybe we want to make choose source image async as a helper method here. So, let's go ahead and do that. To do that, I'm actually going to just select this code. And I'm going to right-click. I could do it manually, but what I'm going to use is the extract method refactoring. If you've played with async, there were some issues, some limitations to that. We actually invested again for between beta and RC to make sure this works great for async methods. And so what I can say now is extract method, and we see, actually before I do that, we can see that inside this code, the code that I have, the only thing I actually care about after this code block is this original file method, or this original file local here. This is what's going to store the file that the user actually chooses. And obviously, I need to use that file down here later when I create the mosaic. So we're just going to make sure that our method actually returns that particular local. So I'm going to say here again, right-click, refactor extract method. And I'm going to call this choose source image async. And we see that the code that it's going to generate, the method it's going to generate, is a method that is async, right? And we know we need this method to be async because we see that there's awaits inside there. Again, if you want to do awaits, if you want this compiler magic, your method needs to be marked async. But we're actually seeing something else here. We're seeing that the method I'm generating is going to return a task. If we take a look, I'm actually going to generate this and go up here. If we see the current method I'm in, we see that this is an event handler. And because it's an event handler, it has a signature that returns void. Right? And so by putting async here, I'm simply making it so I can chunk up my method into these different, implicit callbacks. But I'm still returning void. However, if I look what I want here, I want this choose source image async method. I want the ability to await it. I want to make a helper method that I can actually call, know when it's done, and not just know when it's done, but also get a result back. And for that, I need this to actually return me one of these future objects that I can await, just like all of the framework methods that I'm calling. And so if I go to definition here, I can see the method that was generated for me. I see it's returning me a task of storage file. That's good because I want to get that original file value out when I'm done. And I have all the same code in here. And you see I'm just able to await the way I was awaiting before. And if I look what's going on here, though, what am I doing? Well, I get into this method. It's going to go on just like it did here. And it's going to get to this await. And what's going to happen at this await? The same thing that happened inside my event handler. When control flow reaches here and I get to pick single file async, I'm doing this first asynchronous operation, my first latent operation that's not yet going to be done by the time I call it, I'm going to need to return. So I get to await. I'm going to return to my caller. But what I'm going to return is this task of storage file. Right? And so the way that you actually get this ability to track the future operation is that every time you return, or the first time an async method returns, it's returning that task that the compiler is creating for you. And that's what lets the person who called you, who's going to await you, track when you're complete. And so this is returned. It actually goes back up here. Choose source image async. This returns a task. We're awaiting that task, the task of storage file. And we're awaiting it. And remember, this is going to be the first await inside this event handler. And so it's going to return. And so it's going to go back to the message pump all the way up the stack until that gets you back there. We can pump other messages and keep the UI responsive. And then, sometime later, 5 seconds later, 10 seconds later, that network request finally finishes. In this case, picking a single file actually finishes. The user finishes manipulating the UI. And they choose it, and they continue on. And then we get to continue running here. But this time, we're continuing running inside of our helper method. We get to go in here. We're stepping through our code. We're saying, all right, we want to open async. We want to set this as our XAML, as our XAML image source after we've come back from that operation. And then finally, we get to the bottom here, and we're saying return original file. But we already returned, right? We returned up here at the await. And if I look at the type of original file, I see, this is a storage file. It's the logical result type of my method. But I see that the sort of physical result type of my method was task of storage file. So I've already returned that. What does return mean here? Well, inside an async method, what return actually means is not return this object raw, but go to the task that we've already returned, the task of storage file, and set this as the result. Set this as the result for that task. And not only does it put the result into the task, it also will tell that task it's time for it to signal completion. So anybody who's registered a callback who wants to know when that task is complete now is going to go say, all right, you're going to call my callback, and you're going to give it this result object that I've returned from this method. All right, so I have the ability to do that now. I call this, it comes back up here, and I should get the same behavior that I have before. Now, one thing you notice is I'm able to await things that are iasync operations. I'm able to await tasks. I can await all sorts of things. I could actually await other objects, F#, future objects that are returned. You know, if you were making some agent library or other interesting, fun things, you could make your own awaitable types. But just one thing to know is that when you are writing an async method, the task type is actually special. Task and task of T are the two types that you can actually produce and return from an async method. And so if you want to make an API that was going to return some other type, you would return your task and then maybe wrap it in some other type. But generally, when you're doing this kind of programming, all you have to think about is task, and that's fine on the production side. Yep.
So after the call to the await, are you always back on the original calling thread?
Yes. So one important point, we'll cover that a bit when we get to task.run, but one important point to note here is that await actually does some extra work to ensure that not only are you doing this request, but it actually, whatever it is, but when it's done, it actually resumes you in the context where you left off. So if you're on the UI thread, it puts you back on the UI thread. If you're on a background thread, it's going to put you back onto a background thread in the thread pool. It doesn't necessarily guarantee it's the same thread, but you're in a similar threading context. That way your code can do what you'd expect it to do.
How many threads it will create for, I mean, if you have 10,000 await, mm-hmm.
So that's actually something really important to know about async. So a lot of what it looks like you're thinking of awaiting and, you know, is it actually spinning up threads? Is it doing this and that? What I'm doing here, I'm on the UI thread when I start, and every one of these things is actually staying on the UI thread. By using async in this way, I'm actually avoiding creating any threads whatsoever. So as we saw in the slides, when I go and I call that method, while I'm waiting for the thing to go, no thread is actually active waiting on it. It's simply that I have, in a data structure, for that future object, my callback waiting. And the compiler does some magic so it knows how to resume inside my method and actually pick up logically where it left off. But there's no thread that's spinning its wheels trying to wait for that to be happening. I'm able to just use the thread that I have in a very efficient way. So the question is there an issue with resource contention? One of the benefits of having the UI thread model and actually doing all of this stuff on one thread instead of being multi-threaded is that you sort of get an implicit lock on your UI state. Sort of one of the core reasons people use a UI thread rather than just having multiple threads is so that you only know you have one sequential block of code that's going to be accessing the UI at a time. And in fact, between any of these awaits, I can guarantee that nobody else is going to jump in and try to do any UI operations that are going to maybe invalidate the stuff that I'm doing. So I have that benefit, right? It's sort of, you know, you go back from multi-threading to sort of this preemptive multitasking in a way. So it's sort of, you know, Windows 3.1 you could think of again, right? But in that sort of way that you want a UI thread, it's a very common programming model. And it's because you don't really want to have to think about at any given moment somebody interrupting you and taking explicit locks on the UI state. It's very nice to be able to have that chunking, something that you can make explicit in terms of where you put your awaits. So again, it's not that it actually helps you in terms of preventing all problems you could have. In fact, we're going to see later, I'm going to show something about cancellation. And, you know, I like to say, with great responsiveness comes great responsibility. You have some new problems that you actually get when you have asynchrony. And they're good problems to have. It's that, hey, now that my app is responsive, I have to worry about reentrancy. Now that my app is responsive, what if the user wants to cancel or see progress or those kind of things, right? So it's not that when you do this, you suddenly have all of those problems handled, but you actually get to pay as you go in terms of solving them. I can do a bit of incremental work to do cancellation, a bit of incremental work to handle reentrancy. And, you know, on top of this base layer that we're providing, we fully expect people to start creating, you know, next level UI frameworks that sit on top of this stuff that start to think about and manage reentrancy in those ways. So you can use this stuff directly, but we also think of it as these fundamental building blocks you would use to build up larger context. So the question is, if I'm doing multiple things at once, do I want to put an await on all three and then, you know, wait for them all to finish in parallel? So I'm actually going to show you some stuff in just a bit about parallelization. And I'll probably take some more questions at the end once I show a lot of the rest of this. But you'll see how you can start to do this kind of implicit parallelization just sort of automatically once you have await and once you're actually getting the sort of natural interweaving. So I'll show that. So, all right, we have this method now that we've extracted out. We have choose source image async here. And, you know, we have the successful result. When things get back some data, it's going to go return original file. It's going to set that data inside the task of storage file. But that's not the only way that methods can actually exit. The control flow can leave methods. You can leave through a return statement, but you can also leave through an exception. You know, exceptional control flow is important to manage, especially when you're dealing with inherently lossy things like network calls where stuff can go wrong or things that users can cancel and so on. And so I actually have here two async operations I'm doing inside this method that themselves could throw an exception. You know, and I'm calling open async. Maybe there's an issue actually loading this image if it's over a network or so on, or if it's on a disk that the user disconnects. Maybe when I'm picking the file, something goes wrong showing the UI, and that could throw an exception. But async methods are special in that they're not actually just going to throw their exception back to me as a caller, but they're going to set that exception into their future object. Future objects are great for, you know, tracking when completion occurs and tracking what the result type is, but they're also great for tracking exceptions and knowing when an operation completed successfully versus in an accepted state. And so here, I'm calling pick single file async. Let's assume that this is actually going to throw an exception and see what happens. So to make this exception, I'm actually going to show you one little thing here that's worth knowing about file open picker. If you create a file open picker in Windows 8, one thing to know is you have to set the file type filter. If you don't set a file type filter, it doesn't know which kind of files to show you that are specific to your app, and so it's going to be an error for you to call this API. And so here I'm going to comment out file type filter, and I know this is going to cause me an error when I write this code here. And so, okay, I'm going to call this API. It's not going to throw an exception explicitly. It's actually going to return this iasync operation of storage file in a state that has an exception, and then I'm going to go await that. Well, you know, I could check the object manually, but await actually will help me out here also. Await does the job of, you know, waiting, coming back, giving me a result, but it will also do the job of checking for an exception and resurfacing that exception. So let's say this ends in an accepted state. Well, that exception is going to resurface here at the await expression. So await here is going to throw the exception, and it's going to bubble out inside my method just like a normal synchronous exception would. And what can I do? I can now put a try-catch around it. I don't need special logic for saying, hey, if it was an error and put the error on the synchronous call and then inside the callback and all this other stuff, if you'd done any sort of asynchronous error handling, you know how much of an experience that can be. But what I have here is this ability to just try catch, do the normal exception control flow that I'm used to doing. But taking that one step further, what else can you do with exceptions when they surface? Well, you can also just ignore them inside a given method and let them bubble naturally to the person who called you. Right? Maybe you want to handle your exception at a higher level, and this helper method isn't actually the one that wants to deal with it. And so I can do the same thing here. I actually, just like the exception was bundled up here, I want to bundle the exception into my own task of storage file, have this method end in an accepted state, and have that go out to the caller. And so if I look where I would want this to come out, I go back up here to choose source image async. When I await this, I want the exception to come out here, which it will. The task of storage file is going to have an exception in it. I'm going to await it. That's going to go surface the exception again. Now it's here in my outer method, and I can finally go and do a try catch. So I'm going to go here and say try, take my code, indent it, say catch. In this case, I'm just going to catch all exceptions because I'm only going to show a message here. And I'm going to say, all right, well, if I get an exception during this process, let's go ahead and update the status text to say, oops, an error occurred. All right. And so now I have my error, I have my try-catch outside of it, and when I run, build my app, deploy it, click on flower, and you see that immediately I get this message, oops, an error occurred. And so my exception occurred there on the inside, and it flowed all the way back out. And there's actually something pretty interesting going on. If I take a look here, well, what was this? This was a WinRT async operation. This was an iasync operation, a WinRT future object that I got back. And I ended up implicitly, you know, pulling out the exception here at the await. It was rethrown here into the .NET world and bubbles up from there. And so it came from a WinRT future, but then it was implicitly packaged up in my own task, my own .NET future, when I wrote this async method. And it got into there, went back to my caller. And then here inside the caller, I'm awaiting that. And so I'm awaiting it, and it's resurfacing again. So it's coming from a WinRT future, going out, getting packaged into a .NET future, coming out, going to a try-catch block. And I'm just writing this code as I would think about writing synchronous code, a try-catch block in a method that calls a helper method that throws an exception. That's just normal control flow that I would want to have, what I would want to deal with, and I get to think of it just the same way here. So All right, I now have exceptional control flow here. That's working. But what else can I do? I'm thinking of these future objects. They're first-class objects. But you know, we're not really benefiting so much yet from the fact that they're actual objects. It seems like the only thing I do when I get one is to immediately await it. So what else can I do to deal with the fact these are objects? What other benefits can I obtain? Well, if I go back to, if I go here to the original file, actually, and I look, I see, all right, well, this is returning me my task of storage file. And so if I actually got rid of the await, and I went here and said var original file task, you see that instead of awaiting it and getting out the storage file, I'm now able to just get the actual task of storage file. I can just hold on to the task. And I could then go ahead and just say, you know, var original file equals await original file task. And so that's not too interesting. I just separated the same thing onto two lines. I made an intermediate variable. But what this lets me do now is actually move this second line around. I don't need to do this here. If we take another look at where original file is actually used, we see that the next place it's used is actually all the way down here when I calculate the mosaic. I actually don't need to have the original file chosen yet at the point that we're downloading all the tile images. We already know what tile images to download. The person clicked the Flickr tag. And so I can now separate this out and move this line of code all the way down here. And so this is actually a pretty powerful concept. It's the idea that I can separate the time when I know that I need to do something and I have all the information I need to kick that operation off from the time when I actually need the result. So I'm separating the kickoff from the await. And this actually gives me this idea of implicit parallelization. Like we were talking before about doing multiple awaits. Well, that's what this is letting me do. I'm calling my method up here, and I'm awaiting it all the way down here. And in the interim, I'm able to do further operations. And so if we take a look at what this looks like, I run the app again. Actually, it's probably a good idea if I remove the error before I do that. So I run my app. I go here, and I click flower. And you saw maybe a blip where it said it was already downloading tile images. The user is here using this API before we were, you know, awaiting this, before we even bothered to move on to start calling into any of our APIs to download tile images. But now we didn't await it yet. So the moment the call got there, execution continued. And I can take my time here. I can, you know, sort my one image by date instead of by name. Choose it here. Actually go ahead and open it. And you see that immediately we're calculating the mosaic because we already got through that first phase. Because it was happening in the background while the user was selecting the image. And, you know, so there's times when you're actually going to want to do, you know, very explicit parallelization, split things up, chunk up, especially CPU-bound work, and the task parallel library is great for that. But what you find when you're naturally just interweaving the set of things you want to do in your natural control flow, you often find these kind of places where you can separate kickoff from await and get this benefit of implicit parallelization. And so one last thing to show, I'm actually going to go down back into this method and show how you could do the same thing, not just for .NET tasks, but for WinRT operations. You know, and if I go here, I can do the same thing. I see that this is returning an iasync operation. And so I'm going to do the similar transform here. I'm going to remove the await. I'm going to call this original file operation, since it's not a task, it's an operation. And then I'm going to say var original file equals await the operation. And so again, this does the same thing, not very interesting, just split it onto two lines. But what I can do here now in the middle is some other work, right? I can't actually push this line of code any lower because I happen to need the original file on the next line. But one thing I can do here is go ahead and just say, well, let's do some other work. Actually, I'm just going to say await task.delay 5000. And, you know, this is just a simulation. It represents some other work that's going on. Task.delay is a helper that we have that gives you a task that just pauses for some number of seconds and then resumes, right? And so it's going to, you know, call the callback and continue my method after 5,000 milliseconds, after 5 seconds. And so I can use this and say that this simulates some sort of very important work that's going on. But, you know, I'm able now to do this, even though pick single file async is an iasync operation, it's a WinRT operation, but task.delay is going to return me a task. So I'm dealing both with .NET futures and with WinRT futures, but I'm able to easily just interweave them. I don't have to think about which is which. I'm able to use them interchangeably. One last thing before we go back to the slides. You know, there's often you can use them interchangeably, but there are a few cases where you actually need to know that these things are tasks. You need to create some sort of task wrapper around the WinRT object. And there actually used to be a lot more at the developer preview when we released this build there were some more fundamental differences between the way .NET futures and WinRT futures operated. One thing we like to say about .NET future types, about the task type, is that it represents a hot task. And a hot task means that when you call an API that gives you one of these objects, you can be confident that that object is already in flight, that the operation is already running. There's no start method that you're supposed to call to actually really kick it off. But this wasn't true of the WinRT objects. The WinRT object would give you back an operation, and you would call start on it. And that would tell the operation that you want it to go and start whatever processing, downloading it is that you were asking it to do. And, you know, it's just an API difference, but it was a point of difference between these two things. You'd have to actually reason about that when you were trying to mix and match between them. And you know, one thing you would do, if I actually set a breakpoint here and I step, we can see the benefit of actually having these hot tasks. I'm going to step in here, click flower, and you see when I'm stepping, because I have hot tasks here, I'm able to step past this line. I'm saying picker.pick single file async. I'm asking the UI to show this. You notice it doesn't show quite yet because the UI thread hasn't had that chance to pump. Again, I have that preemptive multitasking we were talking about. I'm able to just go through in order. But then I finally get to an await. So I get to my await, I release control to the UI, and you see that now it shows this. And the UI is already there. I didn't await this method yet. But you see that it actually already showed it and let me interact with it. And then afterwards, my task.delay, you know, paused for 5 seconds, came back. And now finally, I'm able to await this. And when I await it, I go back in here, and I can choose open, and it continues on. And so I have that ability to do that because I have this concept of hot tasks. The very act of calling this API causes that to appear. What you would have to do previously was to call a method called start as task. Actually, if you wanted that same behavior for a WinRT operation, you'd have to remember, I'm calling a WinRT operation, I'm going to call start as task. It's going to let me know, or it's going to give me a task wrapper. Implicitly in getting one, it's going to actually start the operation and let me have this implicit parallelization. But it was, at the same time, very easy to forget to do that, and you'd have some very subtle bugs. So one of the things we've changed, if you're using beta or RC, you have now just operations that come back from WinRT APIs, they're already started. And so you can often just hold on to the operation. You don't have to bother converting it to a task. But if you did want to, you can call as task. And now instead of, you know, an iasync operation of storage file, as task will wrap that as you can see here, a task of storage file. And I can hold on to that and move forward. And we'll see a few reasons why you'd actually still want to do that in the future. Oh, so actually go back here to my slides. And if we look at the new keywords here, well, we have the async keyword that we saw on top of the method. And async just simply means that I'm going to make my method asynchronous. The compiler is going to do the work behind the scenes to figure out how it can chunk my method up so that I can pause it and I can resume it. Actually, under the covers, the way it works, it is a state machine. It's sort of similar to the way iterators work. But you don't need to think about that. All you think about is your sequential code flow, and you let the compiler do the rest. And, you know, within your method that you mark async, each point where you say await makes the, quote, rest of the method the callback for that particular future object that you're awaiting. And, you know, that way the future object doesn't have to know anything special about the fact that you're using async. In the case of Windows runtime, it doesn't even have to know that you're using C# or Visual Basic because those APIs are available to C++ and JavaScript. But because they offer this shape that we can recognize, we're able to integrate them into to .NET, into our async story here. And let you await those objects. And so, you know, we talked about some of the differences that we have between .NET tasks and, you know, Windows runtime operations. You have sort of two types on the .NET side. There's task and task of T result. Those are when you do or don't, or don't or do have a result, respectively. And there's the similar tasks over on the Windows runtime side. Those are iasync action, iasync operation of T. That's when you know, iasync action is when you don't have a result. Async operation is when you do. And there were some differences, again, at build. You know, the core difference was that tasks are already running and the Windows runtime operations were not. And so it had some differences in the operations you could perform. You could await both of them directly, right? If you were to await an operation, we would go ahead and start it for you. But it meant that you could only await it once. If you were awaiting it and we had to hook up this kind of callback for you and start the operation for you, we couldn't do that twice. So if you actually went to await it again, it would have to be an error. Whereas on the .NET side, you're easily able to await things multiple times as you need to. It'll just simply wait the first time, and afterwards it pulls the result out. And you could also store a task and await it later. But we saw that if you were to call or not call start as task, if you were to get back this Windows runtime operation and forget to call start as task, it might not actually be going, and that could be confusing. And so since the developer preview, we've taken that change on the Windows runtime side to have hot operations. And that means that now a lot of these differences are eliminated. And so we already have running tasks when you call Windows Runtime API. It means you can await them directly. It means you can await them multiple times. There's no problem with doing that now. So you have just as easy of a time setting up complex control flow that uses an operation. You can store that operation, easily await it later, like we saw inside choose source image async. I was able to store it, do some other sort of delay in 5 seconds, and come back and await it. And I was doing it as naturally as I could with my regular .NET futures. But you also have the ability to call as task if you want a real task object, and then you can await that later. And we'll see some reasons why we do that in just a bit. And so we also saw two different kinds of methods. I had marked things async, and I had, you know, my initial event handler, which was async void. But then when I made a helper method, I made that async task. And really the difference between these two is whether you have the ability to go ahead and await that async method that you're creating. So if I make an async task method, I can await it. What I'm doing is giving control to my caller so he can figure out when execution of this method completes. You know, if you think of a normal method in a synchronous case, well, you know when you call it, it finishes, and you know when it completes. And so knowing when something completes is usually actually pretty important to getting your flow correct, especially if it's going to complete and actually give you a value that you care about. But there's some cases where you don't necessarily care. One of those cases is event handlers. So for example, in the UI, I click the button, I click one of those things on the left-hand side, and it creates this flow. It creates this async flow to actually go through the code that I wrote. But the message pump inside the XAML engine doesn't actually care when my click event completes. It only cares when it can get control back so it can go schedule some other things. It's up to me to handle my control flow. So in those cases where you have things like event handlers or other kind of void contracts that exist, async void methods are useful. But generally, otherwise, if you're going to make helper methods, you probably want them to be task-returning helper methods so that you can at least know when completion occurs, but also go back and get a result. So we've seen sort of this simple case of how you can use async. But when you have these future objects, you can do more interesting things. We saw implicit parallelism simply by interweaving when I kick things off and when I await them. But I can do more explicit operations that actually start to build on the future objects that I get back. And so let's take a look at some of that. Go back to my demo. And one thing I might want to do here, if I go back up to my original method here, I'm actually going to remove this important work first. One thing I might want to do, somebody was asking about it before, was that this idea of background work, right? Background work that actually is CPU-bound work that I'm going to want to do on another thread. So far, everything that you've seen me do in these methods, all the awaits that I'm doing, are always putting me back on the UI thread. I'm not spinning up new threads in order to accomplish this. But I might actually want to, for some reason. If I actually know that I'm going to do a bunch of CPU work that is going to take a while, I might need to spin up a background thread to keep things responsive. And so, for example, here I'm calling parse photos from XML. This is a helper method I have. It pulls apart the Flickr URI, the Flickr result that comes back from my URI. And all right, while I'm doing that, it should be pretty quick, but maybe I'm on a device that's actually not that powerful. Maybe I'm getting back more XML than I expect from Flickr or something. So let's say that I profile and I find out that this is actually taking a while on my UI thread, and I want to go do this work on a background thread to make things more responsive. I could do this today. I could, you know, take a thread, new thread, set up a delegate, have this go off, figure out when it completes and register and figure stuff out, or maybe put all my work on a background thread, and every time I want to update the UI, I'm doing dispatcher.invoke async or something like that. But really, I only have this little nugget of functionality that I want to do on a background thread. The rest of my code, I was pretty successfully multiplexing on the UI thread. I didn't need to go put the whole thing there and deal with all this manual marshalling back and forth. So can't I just do that little nugget when I want to? And the answer is yes. So what I can do here, instead of just calling parse photos from XML, I can say await task.run and then make a lambda expression here. And my lambda expression is going to call that same method. And so what I'm saying now is, all right, well, what I want to do, what I want to run on a background thread is this parse photos from XML method that's going to return me this iList of photo info, all the URLs that I have. But when I call task.run, you see what it gives me is a task of iList of photo info. And so it's taken the result that I know I'm going to get from that lambda expression and wrapped it up in a task that I can now await. And you see that my code now is letting me treat this in exactly the same way I treated all of the other network methods that I had. I have a .NET API here that I'm calling. I have other things that I'm doing here. But then I'm actually able to call this test.run method and get back this implicit task that's created for me, and I can await it.
Within that test.run code, if you throw an exception or exception occurs, what kind of exception is that? Is that an aggregate exception? Is it going to go back to the normal flow, or how do you handle
that? So the question was around exceptions. What happens if an exception occurs inside the test.run method? So there were some things you're talking about, aggregate exceptions, like if you're using task today in .NET 4.0, there's some things to deal with aggregate exceptions in terms of having maybe there's multiple tasks that are giving you different exceptions, you're combining them together. One thing we do is if you get an exception in this case, it actually would be in an aggregate exception, but we pave over all of that for you. The act of awaiting this task here means that, again, it's just as simple as the other features that I have. If there's a result, that result is going to pop out and I'm going to store it in Photos. If that inner lambda ended in an exception, that exception would be thrown, it would be captured into the task, returned, and then when it surfaced, we would unpack the aggregate exception and then surface the exception out to you. And so whether you have successful completion or you have an exception as your completion, you're able to just think of it the same way. And the exception isn't lost. You're able to deal with it. So when I call async, so the question is, for the other operations we're doing, is it on another thread at all?
It is running technically in the background if the UI remains responsive.
Well, so one of the things that happens, take for example this network call that I'm doing here. I'm making a network call out to a UI, and I'm asking, under the covers, when you get all the way down to it inside the methods, it's asking the OS to go do a network request to another server. But all that it does at that point is it puts in a data structure the callback to actually come back that's going to bubble out and come back to my code. While we wait for that other server to come back and give us the results, the OS and nobody here on our side actually has a thread that's dedicated to that request. It's only when some data comes back on that socket, it wakes up and goes inside the OS, figures out that data is for me, and it comes all the way back to me. And then it's going to say, all right, well, this was supposed to be scheduled on this particular UI thread. It remembers that we wanted to schedule this back here on the UI thread. It's going to go use the same thread that I have, that I started from, and add some work to the XAML message pump. And when it gets around to it, it's going to say, here's the work we want to do, which is to resume this method and pick up where we left off. And so in that interim period, maybe I'm waiting a minute for the server to respond to me. I don't have any thread that was created. And that's the benefit of having the OS expose these kind of asynchronous APIs to you, that you don't need to have another thread which you spin up and then block waiting for a synchronous API to complete. If you have asynchronous building blocks at the lowest level, sort of your axioms that you're building on, if those things are asynchronous, you don't need to have a thread under the covers. I'm sorry? No, and that's the difference, right? So there's sort of these two kinds of things that you're doing, right? And it's important to actually make a distinction between them. So when I'm doing sort of I/O parallelism or this network parallelism or I/O operation, I/O bound operation, or network bound operation, the reason that I'm able to stay responsive is because my machine is actually, or my CPU is not the one that's doing the work. When I make a network request, what I'm waiting on is some other machine to do some work and some routers to do work and sending that data to me. But I don't actually need my CPU to think about that or do anything active in terms of waiting for the other machine to respond. The other thing is, imagine I'm loading a file from disk. That is my computer, but I'm actually waiting for the hard drive to return data to me. And while the hard drive is coming back and processing and figuring out the data and putting it into the buffer and so on, I don't need to think about that. And my thread is not caught up waiting for the hard drive to seek and find the data. And so it's about figuring out those times when you can depend on other machines or other devices within your computer besides your CPU to be doing work. And you don't have to be spinning the CPU figuring out when that's going to happen. Now, when using threads, you're also not spinning the CPU. You'd schedule some other thread. But threads actually have overhead. There's a stack that's allocated for the thread and so on. So you could do this by spinning up a thread, having it wait, block. But then each one of those threads that you want to do that for, that's going to start consuming stack. In the case of the server, we were talking about how that affects scalability. In the case of the UI here, I could do that, but it actually starts to affect the maintainability of my code because I'm on this background thread. Well, now I want to update the UI. I have to dispatch back to the UI thread, but now I want to do background work, and I have to dispatch back there. And dealing with all of that sort of manual dispatching back and forth can get very complex if you have an app that's doing anything more than something pretty simple.
So within that task.run, you would
Yes, so I would have to, if I was inside this Lambda and I wanted to do a UI operation, I would need to do dispatcher.invoke. But what you often find is that you can sort of invert that pattern. Like you see here, this is still a UI method, this event handler. But because I was able to do this little chunk of functionality, which involved getting data but not actually displaying it, I was able to get the data back here onto the UI thread. And then later, just naturally, I'm already back there. I'm already on the UI thread, and I can continue doing my stuff. And you know, personally, when I'm writing these kind of apps, I've started to find it a lot more natural to think of the blips of long-running functionality that I do rather than sort of the reverse model we have today where you say, I'm going to go onto a background thread and keep poking to the UI thread repeatedly. But you know, again, that's a matter of taste. You have the full ability to do that kind of dispatching. If you have one little blip there, maybe to update a progress indicator or something, you can go ahead and make that happen. OK, and so I have this. I'm doing task.run. I'm doing my CPU work here. And you know, and there's other stuff I could do, right? For example, I could take this and maybe I want to do more than one thing here. I want to do you know, something else. And the something else that I want to do could actually be maybe another set of you know, important work, right? Some very important work here. And in this case, I want to do these two things, but here I'm awaiting, right? And you see that I'm awaiting, and it says the await operator can only be used inside an async Lambda expression. So you know, my method that I'm outside here, this is async, but I've made a Lambda, and the Lambda is its own method that I have to deal with, right? Its own little sort of implicit method that's created. And so the way I would do that is I could mark this async up here. And so it's worth noting that I can go ahead and actually create that, those kind of async Lambdas and rig that all together. But I'm going to undo all that. So, oops, actually, not quite so far. All right, so I now have this work being done on a background thread. Well, what else can I do? I might want to do, actually, see here. Actually, just one other principle that's worth thinking about. If you look at the Windows runtime and sort of the way you design these APIs, we were talking about when you would take this nugget and send it off to a background thread. The way the Windows runtime APIs were designed, they took a look not just at the sort of classic things like network I/O and file I/O. Even like part of what this app does under the covers back in the munging of the data, it's doing async operations just to resize images. It's asking Windows runtime to resize an image, and that could take maybe more than 50 milliseconds if it's a large image. And so those even CPU crunching algorithms that I'm talking to inside the Windows runtime, those themselves are going to be async. And really, you know, you can think of that kind of principle. If you're offering up a method, and that method could take longer than 50 milliseconds, you may want to consider doing your own task.run inside your method and offering your functionality to your callers as an async method, just to make it very easy for them to await what you're doing and then continue on. OK, so we've seen task.run. But there's one other kind of combinator I wanted to show, and that's task.whenany. You may have seen previous demos where we've shown task.whenall. This is a method that takes a whole bunch of tasks. It's going to take a series of tasks and then return you a new task that completes only when all of those tasks are finished. And you can do various interesting things with that. But what I'm going to show is task.whenany. It's something that does something similar, but instead you give it a sequence of tasks and it's going to return when one of those tasks completes. And so if I go down here, I'm going to say, let's see here, task.whenany. What I'm going to say is here, I'm calculating the mosaic. What do I want to do? I want to do something interesting. I'm going to do a soft timeout. This idea that, all right, I'm going to call this create mosaic async method is going to generate a mosaic for me. But the mosaic, you know, might take a while to generate. You see that it can take like 5-6 seconds. The user might not think the app is responsive during that time. So maybe what I want to do is if you get a few seconds in and they haven't seen anything happen, maybe I'll update the UI to say that we're still calculating. And so what I can do here is split this up the same way. I'm going to say var mosaic task equals, and I'm going to say var mosaic equals await mosaic task. And then down below, you know, I can push this out, here. And then, you know, in between when I actually, you know, get my mosaic task and I actually await it, I can do something else. And in this case, what I'm going to do is a timeout. So I'm going to make a delay task. And I'm going to say here, task.delay of 3,000 milliseconds. And in this case, it's not some fake work. This actually represents a delay, a real delay that I want to have. And what I can then do is come down here and say task.whenany. And I can pass both the mosaic task and the delay task. And then what I want to do is actually take the return value of this, which I'm going to call first task. And so if I look at what whenany returns, I see that I'm calling it, I'm giving it these two tasks, and what it returns is something funny. It's a task of task. So that sounds kind of crazy, but it actually makes sense if you look at it. The outer task is simply what we expect, right? Whenany is going to return when one of the tasks is done. It has to give me an async a future for me to actually track that. So that's what the outer task does. It completes when one of the tasks inside completes. But what it gives me as a convenience is it says, hey, by the way, here's the task that completed first. Here's that first task that caused me to return to you. And so I'm going to know which of those tasks actually finished first. And so I can then go ahead and do a test. If, you know, I have these future objects, they're first class objects, I can do all sorts of stuff I expect to do with first class objects, such as test for reference equality. So I can say if first task equals delay task, if the task that finished first is that timeout and the mosaic task is still going, then I'm going to say model.statusText equals still calculating. And then down here, we're going to await this. And actually, I'm going to be sure to await task.whenany up here just to make sure I get out that task. All right? And so now I'm going to run this. It's going to deploy. I'm going to click flower. I'm going to go in here, choose my image, click open. It's calculating the mosaic. You see it's thinking. It says still calculating because 3 seconds elapsed, but then the operation completes. So it was able to do those two things in parallel, both the actual processing that I wanted it to do along with the timeout that it was using to figure out when it was time to show the message that I wanted. Okay. So that's one thing I can do. And, you know, I'm not going to actually show whenany here for winRT task, but you can start to see the benefit of having this as task method around. Task.whenany is a method that accepts a params array of tasks. And so, you know, it's great that I can await winRT operations and I can hold on to them for later, but sometimes I really just need a task. If I want to call task.whenany and I wanted to pass it pick single file async, it's going to be good that I've actually called as task here because I've actually gotten back a task that I could send along to whenany. And so having that ability to get a task helps you when you start to build these higher level methods on top of tasks that do things like timeouts and so on. Yeah, so the question is, would you put it in a loop? Yeah, you could certainly put it in a loop. You could schedule another task and see if the thing completes then. I've seen whenany used in loops for other purposes in terms of saying, well, I'm going to kick off 10 downloads. When any of them complete, I want to process that download that completed, and then I want to call whenany again with that one thing removed. And so you keep calling whenany with the things removed, and then you know another one of them is complete, and you keep processing them as they come in. So you can do all sorts of interesting things like that with whenany. And yeah, the fact that you can easily write loops inside your async methods helps you be very creative there. So I'm going to go back to the code, or back to the slides, rather. And if we look, we've seen the task type as this future type in .NET, but because we've built all these combinators around the type, it becomes this type that lets you more generally just coordinate activities in your app. And so I'm able to say task.whenany and construct things like timeouts or construct things like, you know, throttling. Maybe I'm going to use whenany to say, you know, do something, but only do them one at a time, only let three of these come through. You can start to build these APIs up, and people have started to do that and created these libraries that you can consume that build on top of task. And, you know, we give you a set of these helpers inside the framework. And so you've seen task.delay. It lets you make a timeout for a certain number of seconds and have it wake up after that time. Task.yield is sort of its little brother that says, all right, well, yield for sort of the minimal time possible. Let a few messages pump on the UI thread probably and, you know, come back later, right? It lets you perhaps let things breathe if you need to. Task.run is this way we can push things back to a background thread. If I want CPU-bound work, something I know I actually need to do on a background thread in parallel with my app because it involves my own CPU, my processor, I can do task.run there. And also this kind of parallel composition. I can say task.whenany or task.whenall. If the implicit parallelism of doing that interweaving doesn't work out for me, if I need more power, I can use these constructs to actually build up this parallelism that I want. And we fully expect that there's going to be all sorts of APIs that provide even higher level abstractions over all the task stuff that we're providing in .NET 4.5. And so for the final demo, I wanted to show a bit about cancellation. You know, we've seen ways that you can get results back from these operations, these futures, these things that you're calling. But that's really about getting results out, maybe a result, maybe an exception. But sometimes you need to communicate to that ongoing operation. You know, if I have something that's in flight, maybe I want to cancel it. Maybe I don't need to get the result anymore. Maybe the user has actually clicked a cancel button in the UI. And so if they've done that, I know that I can, you know, I want to cancel it. I want to be able to tell the UI, or sorry, tell the operation that. And so let's actually see what that would look like inside .NET, inside WinRT. Go back to my demo. And if I look back up here at ItemClick as the event handler, I can see a few things that I might want to cancel. Probably the one I might want to cancel most is the one that takes the longest. It's this process of actually creating the mosaic. You know, that takes maybe 6 seconds, probably, you know, six, if I was using a bigger image, it could take 10 seconds, 15 seconds. While that's going on, if the user decides, oh, I don't want this mosaic anymore, I want to be able to abort that process gracefully. And so if I take a look, we can see that there's actually an optional parameter that I haven't talked to yet on Create Mosaic Async, which is called cancellation token. And if you think of task as the type in .NET that serves as this, you know, first-class notion of an ongoing work of an async operation, cancellation token provides this first-class notion of cancellation. It's how I represent the fact that I may want to cancel something in the future as a token that I can give out to a set of operations who can then give it to the operations that they call. And so what I would do is have a cancellation token, pass it to this operation, but also pass it to all the other operations I'm dealing with. And then at some time in the future, when I want to maybe cancel, I could signal cancellation on that token. And then whatever operation happens to be in flight that's tracking that token will know that it's supposed to cancel itself and abort what it's doing. I don't have to keep track of what the current operation is so that I can go and cancel that particular thing. Having everybody get the same token lets that be handled automatically for me. And so if I want to go ahead and do this, the way you get a cancellation token is I use a type called cancellation token source. Makes sense. I'm going to put this at class level for now. You'll see why in a bit. And when I kick off something that I might want to cancel, such as this item click operation here, I'm going to go ahead and make myself a new cancellation token source. All right, I've got this here. If I go back down to the bottom, the very bottom of this, I'm going to set it to null. And so now I can look at the source to actually know whether I have something worth canceling. And now, as I go through my API calls that I'm doing here, I'm going to go ahead and say, all right, well, when I call create mosaic async, I have my source. And what I want to do on the source is call .token. And this gets the cancellation token that that source is generating. And so the reason for actually separating these onto two different types rather than saying just new cancellation token is to give me the control as the person running the operation to say, I want to be able to trigger cancellation. You imagine I'm giving this token to somebody, they're going to give it to somebody else. There could be tens of methods that have a hold of this token. I don't want any of those methods to be able to trigger cancellation. Only I should be able to do that. And so you think of cancellation tokens as being this light bulb that lights up to signal cancellation. A cancellation token source is sort of the big red button that I hold on to and can press that actually tells all those light bulbs to light up so people know that they should abort. So I'm holding on to that, and now I'm passing that generated token around. So I'm going to call here create mosaic async, pass the token. There's other things going on here, like fetch images async. Well, I see that this accepts a token as well, so I'm going to pass that. Now, those are two helper methods that I wrote, but for example here, get async. This is a method that's defined in the .NET framework, .NET 4.5, that new API, but I'm able to pass a cancellation token there as well. So I'm able to cancel my methods. I'm able to cancel built-in framework methods in just the same way. But also, the other thing we want to do is go up here. We want to be able to cancel our own method, so the method that we're actually writing right now. We see that it doesn't accept a cancellation token parameter. So we can go fix that. If I jump into the definition of the method, well, what do I do? If I want my async method to be cancelable, I go ahead and modify its signature and let it take a cancellation token parameter. So I'm going to call it cancel, and I'm going to make it optional. So I'm going to say equals default of cancellation token. If you leave this off, you're going to get a zeroed out cancellation token. That's okay, because cancellation token is a struct. And it so happens that the behavior when you get that zeroed out struct is just going to be a token that never happens to tell you that it wants to be canceled. If you ask it, it's always going to say, nope, no cancellation. So it serves as a good default, but we're going to let somebody pass in a token here. And now I can go ahead here to methods like open async and actually pass this in, right? You look at, well, pick single file async. I wouldn't really want to cancel that. The user actually might want to cancel it, but there's already a cancel UI there. It already knows how to deal with that. While that full screen UI is showing for the user to pick something, they can't go interact with my main UI and tell me to cancel. So I can leave that alone. But you know, this open async call, this could take a while, right? Maybe I'm opening a network image or so on. This could be something that could be processing for a few seconds. The user might want to cancel during that. So I would want to pass in the cancellation token. But I see that it doesn't accept a cancellation token parameter. So this is another one of those differences that's worth noting between the Windows runtime and between .NET futures, or .NET APIs that are async, which is that .NET has cancellation token parameters. That's the way that it wants to deal with cancellation. The Windows runtime has a slightly different method. If you actually look, well, if I take this future object that comes back, I can see that the iasync operation I have has its own cancel method. So WinRT async futures actually have a first-class notion of cancellation built into them. You just take that operation, you can directly call .cancel on it if you know you want to cancel. And so that can be convenient if you're only doing one or two things. You just call cancel on the thing, you hold onto it and call cancel. But if I'm doing maybe 10 different operations, I might want to cancel this if it's running, but also cancel some .NET task if that's running, or cancel one of my helper methods or so on. And so I really want to get this into that whole idea of using cancellation tokens so I don't have to think about what kind of operation is in flight at the time. And so the way that we do that is, again, with the help of asTask. We saw that when I called asTask, I got a task back, and you see, all right, well, this is iasync operation of stream, this is task of stream. It's all going to do the same thing. I'm awaiting it, same difference. But if I take a look at asTask, we see that there's another overload. There's a second overload of asTask, which takes a cancellation token. And so this is the bridge between cancellation token and the Windows runtime for me. If I want to weave my Windows runtime operations in with cancellation, I can call as task and await that instead. And that gives me the hook to go provide the .NET cancellation token so I can await that. And so I'm going to say here, cancel, and provide that there. And now you see I'm awaiting open async just the way I was, but now I'm awaiting a task that registered for cancellation. And you know, if this cancellation is triggered during that time, .NET's going to do the work behind the scenes to go call .cancel on the operation for you. And so the one last thing, how does cancellation surface? It comes out as an exception because it is a form of exceptional control flow. So you want to abort everything else that you're doing and bubble up until somebody can handle that. And so if this is canceled, an exception is going to surface here. Again, just like all the other exceptions, it'll be packaged up for me in the task and surfaced on the outer layer. And so I go back up here, and I just think, all right, well, any of these things could be canceled, so it's just another kind of exception I have to handle in my try block. So I say here, catch operation canceled exception. And if I get cancellation, let's just go and say item list view dot selected item. We'll just set this to null. And that's going to clear out the UI on the right. Not very metro, but that's just something that we'll do here. And inside here, basically, we're going to rig up this cancellation to somebody clicking the little back button in the corner, just for the purpose of the demo. And the way I rig up cancellation, remember, this is why we put that up there at the class level. It's so that I can now think about that cancellation token and tell it, or the cancellation token source, and tell it to trigger cancellation. So I say, if CTS is not equal to null, that means there's something worth canceling that's going on. I'm going to say CTS.cancel. And then set it to null. All right, so now I run, map deploys, I go and I click flower, go back in, select this, and now while this is processing, I can click the back button up here, and we see that we canceled. And in that case, we happen to be calculating the mosaic, but we could have been running any of those different async operations that was in flight that happened to get that cancellation token. And if it accepted the token, it presumably knows how to abort what it's doing, throw the cancellation exception, bubble all the way back out to the top, and let me handle it in the way that I wanted to, which was to clear out the UI here. Just one sec. So this was cancellation. And if we go back and we look at the kinds of times you'd want to go talk to one of these tasks that's in flight, there's actually another case, which is the idea of progress. You know, with cancellation, you're sending a notion of cancellation to that task that's in flight. But the task might want to communicate with you before it's done in terms of saying, hey, I'm 10% done, I'm 20% done. And we actually have another first-class notion for progress. It's this iProgress type. I'm not going to dig into that. But if I want to actually send that to an operation that I'm calling, I would usually just pass an iProgress, just the same way that I pass a cancellation token. But Windows runtime operations also have this first-class notion of progress, just like they have cancellation. And in that case, I would be able to say, as task, and pass a progress as a parameter on that overload as well. And so this lets me bridge both for cancellation and for progress between these two worlds. And so that's really sort of the core of what I wanted to show you here between how async works and it works with WinRT. If you want to look into this more, you can go to msdn.com/async. We have some white papers up there that show how this works generally. Really the best way to go play with this right now is to download VS2012 RC. You can try this out in your .NET 4.5 apps, just normal apps. You could try it on the server, on the client. But you know, if you want to try out some of the specific APIs we saw today, you can go play around and make Windows 8 Metro-style apps and see how that works. And really sort of that one key point I want you to walk away with is this idea that when you're starting to code and you're getting this complexity and dealing with asynchrony, right, it can be kind of a pain today. And what we're really hoping to do, and we think we've pulled it off, is to be able to get to a world where when you're doing asynchrony, there's really no more callbacks that you ever have to deal with again. So. Thank you.